Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 2nd, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
We'll begin like we do every week with a brief Edgar Steele update. The government is now considering charging Mr. Steele with a felony because he sent his wife a birthday card from jail. Now, that will enable them to tack another 10 years onto his sentence. No, I'm not making that up. You have to understand that the United States of America and its judicial system are the ultimate in human evil. This week we experienced the height of nigger silliness when Barry Satora went on TV and declared that the war in Iraq is over. Now, this is being recorded on Tuesday night, so I haven't actually heard his speech, and I won't because I don't listen to anything niggers have to say. But I'd be willing to almost make a bet that within hours of that bubble-lipped, nappy-headed primate in the Oval Office announcing that the war is over, a few more American soldiers get blown to pieces in Baghdad or Samarra or Fallujah. Now the question is, has anyone told the Iraqis that the war is over? Now, we still have something like 50,000 troops and an unknown but large number of Blackwater mercenaries in Iraq. I wonder if anyone has told the Iraqis that they're not there for combat purposes. To genuine revolutionaries and resistance fighters, an enemy soldier on their land is an enemy soldier. In reality, nothing is going to change, and there will continue to be a regular trickle of American casualties from Iraq from now on, most likely for the next 20 years. Of course, if Obongo attacks Iran, then Iraq will once again become the center of action, since the majority of the Iraqi population consists of Shiite Muslims, and the present so-called Iraqi government is Shiite as well, and it's probably even more of an Iranian puppet regime than it is a U.S. puppet regime. I've had a couple emails from people asking what I thought of the big Glenn Beck rally in Washington, D.C. over the weekend. Well, I would have thought a lot more of it if Beck hadn't been pushing every nigger who wandered into the crowd forward in front of the TV cameras and hobnobbing on the speaker's platform with Martin Lucifer Coon's niece in order to try and prove that he and his followers aren't racist. As if that will do any of them any good in the eyes of the left-wing liberal media, or prevent the media from calling Beck and his people racist because they dare to oppose the mighty Obongo. There is nothing on earth more pointless than white people of any kind trying to win the approval of the liberal news media. Their whole purpose is to create contempt and disrespect for white people and anything to do with Western civilization in general. It's a lost cause, people. Right, first email from Kenny in, actually, I'm sorry, Ken, I've forgotten where you're from. Anyway, the email goes, "Dear Mr. Covington, I have a question. My son is a Whigger, and I have a monkey granddaughter. Does this disqualify me as a Northwest Front member? Thank you, Kenny, 173rd Airborne Brigade." First off, Ken, you have my deepest sympathies. We have a lot of white people in this country who've suffered tragedies like this in their personal lives and their families. I never shout the odds or try to dictate to individuals how they deal with these horrible things that their children or their parents or their brothers or whoever have inflicted on them, but as some of you know, I have some personal experience of this kind of betrayal and foul behavior on the part of family members, so I can definitely relate. However, the crux of your question is, does your son's disgraceful behavior prohibit you in any way from participation in Northwest Front activities? And the answer is no, of course not. However, you used the term Northwest Front member, and so do a lot of people, so don't feel bad. But it looks like we have to run this whole membership thing down again for the benefit of those of you who haven't had time to download all 31 previous Radio Free Northwests and listen to them. No problem. The Northwest Front is not an organization. It's an organism. There is no such thing as a Northwest Front member, per se. No application forms, no membership cards, no formal dues, although we do ask for a voluntary $10 a month. Nothing like that. We use the old Bolshevik concept of defining who's a party member, because Lenin was in the same position as us, in that prior to 1917, under the Tsar, it was physically dangerous to be identified as a Communist Party member, just as it is physically dangerous today to be identified as a white nationalist. A Northwest Front member, if you want to call them that, is someone who lives in the Northwest homeland, who supports the party program in the Northwest migration, and who actively participates therein. By actively participating, we mean someone who lives in the homeland itself and who pays dues or otherwise contributes something besides words to the struggle. Now, the bulk of the people on our list and among our listeners live outside the homeland, and they contribute nothing to the struggle besides words, and sometimes not even words. Mostly they just sit there and listen. Or read. Now, this is why we have no Northwest Republic as yet. Now, if all of the 1,800 or so people on our list lived here in the Northwest, where they're supposed to be, if they all kicked in $10 per month in dues, and if they all actively participated in Northwest Front activity to the fullest of their capacity to do so, then we'd be in the middle of a revolution right now. Instead, most of you continue to sit on your asses, reading and listening, watching and waiting for Harold Covington to pull a rabbit out of a hat, or otherwise entertain you. Our victory will come when this situation ceases, and all of a sudden, you guys out there finally get it into your skulls full of mush that, yes, I mean you. I am talking to you. I mean for you. Yes, you. To get up off your butt and do something. I mean for you. Yes, you. To get up off your ass and pack that moving van and come here to the Northwest homeland, the place where God or whatever you want to call it has appointed for us to fulfill our racial destiny. But getting back to the membership thing, we refer to the Northwest Front sometimes as a party, but that's largely because that's how it was referred to in the Northwest Independence novels. It's not a party in the traditional sense. It's a movement. The Northwest Front has no structure, it has no hierarchy, has no bank accounts. I mention that for the benefit of those Morris D's wannabes out there with itchy legal fingers. Just like I should mention also that the Northwest Front owns no property, and neither do I personally, unless you want to count a car and a computer that are both 12 years old. Sorry, Morris, I'm not the Reverend Dyke, and I don't have any Cadillacs you can seize with a malicious and abusive lawsuit. I'm not even Dave Holland. I don't even own a rowboat. But I'm digressing. The thing is, Ken, that there is no such thing as a Northwest Front member. There are only white people who believe in the Northwest migration and the future of the Northwest American Republic. Now, the way that we show our support or membership in the movement, if you want to call it that, is that we physically come to the homeland and we live here. I don't think you've done that yet, have you, Ken? Well, do it. It doesn't matter what kind of nigger your son married or copulated with. If you're one of those people who absolutely has to have a membership card, like a security blanket to keep you warm, then let's just say that in the Northwest Front, your membership card is your zip code, your zip plus four. Now, that's how you show that you really do support the Northwest Republic. You live here. It's been suggested that at some time in the future, the Northwest Front create a kind of membership status by issuing our own passports for the Northwest American Republic. Of course, for the time being, these would be nothing more than symbolic novelty items until some idiot tried to use one to travel on and got himself arrested, no doubt. But it's an interesting and picturesque idea. I understand the psychological need for a concept of membership and belonging, and the voluntary Northwest Republic passport idea sounds like it might be worth following up at some point in the future. Okay, the next email is from Carl in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Dear Mr. Covington, why do you think the Jews have been so hated and persecuted down through history? Okay, I assume from that question that Carl is new to our movement and he's some kind of conservative or Tea Party type, or else he'd already know enough about the Jews on his own not to have to ask, but I'll give this one a quick shot. And I do mean a quick shot because this subject is so long and complicated that not only have whole books, but the equivalent of whole libraries been written to try and explain the ages-old Jewish phenomenon. Okay, how can I explain this encyclopedic subject in a few hundred words or less? One of the ways you can tell a lot about a people or a culture is by what they consider to be funny, not by the jokes that other people tell about them, their enemies, but the jokes that they tell about themselves. What comes to mind now is an old Jackie Mason joke I heard a while back. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar with him, Jackie Mason is a Jew who got his start back in the 60s as a stand-up comic in what they call the Borscht Belt, which is a string of well-known Jewish summer resorts in the Catskills and the Poconos, and apparently this joke was really popular among all his Jewish audiences back when he was doing his nightclub act. I won't try to do this with Jackie Mason's Yiddish accent, although I understand that with certain audiences, Mason would actually deliver this joke in Yiddish, so it may lose something in the translation, but here goes. Back in the old days in Poland before the war, a Polish businessman gets on a train from Krakow to Warsaw. He sits down in the passenger car and he notices that on the seat in front of him is a little old man, a Hasidic Jew, dressed in a black kaftan with a fur hat and the side locks and the phylacteries, the whole nine yards. Now the train starts up, and as they're going down the track, the old Jew starts whining and complaining. "Oy, I'm so thirsty. Oy, weiss mir, I'm so thirsty." Now, right back at the rear of the car is a large water barrel with some tin cups, but the Jew won't get up and go get himself a cup of water. Instead, he just sits there, mile after mile, whining and crying, "I'm so thirsty. Oy, gewalt, I'm so thirsty." So finally, the Polish businessman has just had enough, and he jumps up and yells, "Oh, all right, damn it!" And he goes down to the end of the passenger car. He fills up a tin cup full of water from the water barrel and brings it to the old Jew. "Here." Now, the old Jew drinks the water down, and the Pole takes the cup back to the end of the car, puts it back on its hook, goes back to his seat, picks up his newspaper, and tries to read it again. And then the old Jew starts up again, whining, "I was so thirsty. Oy, was I ever thirsty." Now, what you have to understand is that apparently to Jews, this joke is funny as hell. Mason used to have whole nightclubs full of kikes rolling on the floor with laughter telling this joke, especially in Yiddish. But when you think about it, it's not funny at all. This old kike whines and moans and makes a disturbance until the Gentile finally gets up and does what he wants, acting as the Jew's personal servant, and then he starts whining and wailing again, purely to annoy and aggravate the Gentile who's just done him a favor. And these people actually consider this to be hysterically funny, and they wonder why everybody on earth wants to kill them. Carl, that's about the best short answer I can give you as to why the Jews are persecuted. They bring it on themselves through their own behavior. It's as simple as that. If you're interested in more information, email me at nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll send you an introductory packet of Northwest Front literature, including one of our instructional leaflets that's entitled just that, Why Are the Jews Persecuted? Right, first music break. A month or so ago, we had a Radio Free Northwest episode in which I devoted the musical section of the program to Civil War songs. And after that one, I had a number of requests for this particular song, and it took me a while to find it on the internet, but eventually I did. Here's Hoyt Axton.
"Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. And for this Yankee nation, I do not give a damn. I'm glad I fought again, I only wish we'd won. I ain't asked any pardon for anything I've done. I hate the Yankee nation and everything they do. I hate the Declaration of Independence, too. I hate the glorious Union, 'tis dripping with our blood. I hate the striped banner, I fit it all I could. I rode with Robert E. Lee for 3 years thereabout. Got wounded in 4 places and I starved at Point Lookout. I caught the rheumatism a-camping in the snow. But I killed a chance of Yankees and I'd like to kill some more. 300,000 Yankees is stiff in southern dust. We got 300,000 before they conquered us. They died of southern fever and southern steel and shot. I wish they were 3 million instead of what we got. I can't take up my musket and fight 'em now no more. But I ain't gonna love 'em now that is certain sure. And I don't want no pardon for what I was and am. I won't be reconstructed and I do not give a damn. Oh, I'm a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. For this Yankee nation, I do not give a damn. I'm glad I fought again, I only wish we'd won. I ain't asked any pardon for anything I've done. I ain't asked any pardon for anything.
By the way, I apologize for the abrupt cutoff at the end there. That was on the original recording. Last week, I asked that you guys get back to me on a couple of topics, and one of them was communism, i.e. exactly what you thought communism was and is. Now, for whatever reason, nobody did, but I promised to talk about that this week, so here goes. There's a kind of myth that world communism perished with glasnost and perestroika in Russia and the fall of the Berlin Wall and the reunification of Germany, so forth and so on, but that's not true. Not only are there still a few countries left that are technically speaking communist, but communism is still very much alive and well on the American University campus today, as well as in the Obama administration and, of course, in the Democratic Party. Now, the forms have changed, that's all. The Democrats practice a kind of decaffeinated communism, Marxism light, if you will, and to be sure, the hand of Obongo is still somewhat less iron than that of Joseph Stalin, although I have to admit that arresting and imprisoning people for what they post on the internet by way of poems and public record information is getting pretty damn close to 1930s Stalinism. Okay, the first thing we need to understand is that capitalism and communism are two sides of the same coin, and both philosophies teach essentially the same thing, i.e. that man is first and foremost an entirely economic animal, devoid of any spiritual or moral dimension. To both communists and capitalists, human beings are units of economic production and consumption, machines that have to be fed and maintained until they're worn out and then thrown on the scrap heap when it becomes too expensive to repair them and cheaper to replace them like spare parts. This essentially is what is now happening to millions of middle-aged white men. They're being tossed into the dumpster and replaced either with third-world aliens or with younger new college graduates who will work far more cheaply and who have no accumulated seniority or experience. We should always remember that capitalism is just as pernicious as Marxism. It's the wealthy capitalists and multinational corporations who brought the illegal aliens here in the first place, remember. National socialists and other white nationalists believe that life shouldn't be like that, that there should be more to life than a cash register. And one of our goals is to create a homeland for our people, not only where they'll be safe and where new generations of white children can be born and raised in sanity and security, but a land where they can be happy and spiritually fulfilled at the same time all their material needs are being met. And that means putting people before profits and before politics. Money is a necessary evil. It's now so ingrained in human culture that it's probably impossible to get rid of the concept altogether. But in a sane and normal world, money is a tool, just like a carpenter's hammer or an electrician's pliers. Money is not and should not become a force or a power in its own right. Now, that's what capitalism is based on, and that's wrong. The object of all economic activity should not be to accumulate wealth or generate profits for someone else. It should be to provide for people and create a healthy and prosperous society where white men and women can thrive and raise children and live out their lives to their full potential. For the past century, the world economy has been a battleground between two conflicting ideologies, Marxist socialism and capitalism. Both of these philosophies are Jewish in origin. Communism is the brainchild of the son of a rabbi, Karl Marx, while capitalism, as we know it, is the result of the seizure of the Western money system by Jewish bankers like the Rothschilds, who practiced the usury system. The only real difference between communism and capitalism is an argument over which group of Jews will get all the marbles, the commissars like Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod, or the Wall Street crowd like Goldman Sachs. Both Marxism and capitalism have the same view of mankind. Man is nothing more than a life form with two arms, two legs, and opposable thumbs with which he can do work for the Jews, a unit of economic production and consumption, and the object of the game is to squeeze as much value and wealth out of each individual as possible while providing him with the least possible amount of food, shelter, clothing, bread, and circuses to keep him on the factory line or driving a truck or plowing the ground or whatever. And yes, labor is a commodity and it has definable value. That much Karl Marx got right. The result of these two competing Jewish worldviews controlling our economics and our culture for so long has been a human and ecological disaster. The planet is being polluted and destroyed almost beyond livability, and I'm sure I don't have to tell you that fewer and fewer people are really happy or productive. The sheer amount of personal and family-related stress which is generated by living in a completely materialistic world is a large part of why society's collapsing, even without adding in the other factors of race and crime and drugs and corruption, which are the byproducts of materialism. I know that the Northwest Republic isn't supposed to be a completely national socialist state, but the fact is that economically speaking, there's going to have to be a lot of very strong NS elements in the Republic if we're going to avoid falling into the same pitfall of laissez-faire capitalism that damn near destroyed us. First off, the Jews and their system of usury, i.e. financing everything with money lent out at interest so that money breeds money, must be completely eliminated from the national economy of the Republic. Economics should be based on production, and by that we mean that everyone in society should contribute something to the common fund, be it creative research or craftsmanship or even simple labor. But everybody should make a tangible contribution of something other than pieces of paper called money. It's a matter of producers versus parasites, and one of the reasons the Western economy is in the bad shape it's in right now is the fact that there are finally getting to be too many parasites, too few people paying the taxes, and too many eating the taxes. And once you get past a certain tipping point, the whole house of cards is going to start coming down. And we're seeing this in Europe already, in Greece and elsewhere, and we're also seeing it in certain American states like California and Illinois, which are about to go broke because there simply isn't any more money. Secondly, it's an ironclad fact of economic life that wealth is created by free enterprise, because people simply won't work to their full capacities unless they are rewarded in some way. Now, there's a very important difference between free enterprise and capitalism. Free enterprise is where a man is free to work at what he's good at and to keep the bulk of his earnings, with the state taking only the bare minimum necessary to provide necessary goods and services for all, like medical care, law and order, and defense. Capitalism is where money and the possession of huge sums of money, more than any individual would ever need or could ever spend, becomes a power in and of itself. Money is like fire. Properly used, it will warm you and cook your food, but if you let the fire get out of control and too big, it'll burn down the house. Now that's the difference between free enterprise and capitalism, the difference between the fire staying in the stove and getting too big and burning everything down. In a Marxist socialist state, this problem is solved, or allegedly solved anyway, by making all money, all housing, and basically everything else the property of the state, with the government deciding who gets what. Now this is what Obongo and his Jew crew in the White House are shooting for here in America. For example, they're in the process of becoming the country's largest landlords by taking over government-guaranteed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac defaulted mortgages and readjusting them, forgiving part of them, so that the householder ends up more or less paying his mortgage to the government through the state body that guaranteed the original private mortgage. The federal and state governments are already the country's biggest employers, and government employees are the only ones who aren't hurting financially. Washington, D.C., and the suburbs of D.C. as well as certain state capitals, are the only places in the country that aren't experiencing depression right now. It's a long, slow process, and people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh are actually doing quite a good job of documenting it, much better than I can here. The greatest producer of wealth that any white society has is the immense productivity and creativity of the white worker. That's what the Northwest Republic will have to rely on in order to create our new economy, not borrowed money and not crushing taxation. The state will have to be socialist in the sense that it will be the duty of the nation to train our people, to motivate them, to employ them in every capacity in which they can be useful, and to make sure that they're rewarded commensurate with their abilities and the value of their labor. But using workers as an expendable resource like communism and capitalism do is not only cruel and inhuman, it's also stupid and wasteful. And in the Republic, stupidity and waste will be things that we won't be able to afford. I don't have to tell anybody listening to this that modern-day American business is grossly inefficient, and it's top-heavy with useless middle management who are complete jerks. Those of you who read the Dilbert cartoons in the papers know how true to life they are. And the Dilbert scenario applies to every aspect of American economic life. The very thought that companies can get better productivity and higher profits by not mistreating their workers and by not using them as livestock just never seems to occur to American employers. Now, the first step economically for the Republic will have been taken by the revolution itself when we eliminate Jews and usury from the economy and when we've established a national economy based on productivity and investment rather than debt and interest. Next, we'll have to create the National Labor Service I referred to in The Hill of the Ravens so that any problems with unemployment are solved by giving people jobs, not welfare checks or entitlements. In every society, there's always work to be done. The problems are caused by arguments over who does the work and who reaps the profits. Inflation is another economic problem which we won't have to deal with in the Republic because the Jews will no longer be controlling our money supply through the Federal Reserve. Inflation is caused in part by shortages of goods. True, and I, for one, am not one of these libertarian types who screams in horror at the thought of price controls for certain necessary basic commodities like food and energy and shelter. But the inflationary spiral is basically the result of the government printing paper money hand over fist when they can't collect enough taxes to pay their bills, as is starting to be the case in this country under Obama. Now, if you carefully control the money supply, you control inflation, you control prices, and you can control wages. If the government lives within its means and doesn't borrow money, then you've got no deficits. Now, the main thing you guys need to remember is that both communism and capitalism have been tried before. Communism doesn't work at all without concentration camps and forced labor and mass arrests and all the sort of merry crap that happened under Stalin. A lot of people wonder why Stalin did all the things he did in the 1930s and enslaved 10% of the population. It wasn't so much because he was mad or anything like that, although he was. The fact is that it was the only way that he could get the communist system to function economically. Communism won't work without a huge fund of slave labor. And capitalism works, well, kind of, so long as everything is smooth sailing. But at the first sign of trouble, the capitalist system starts to throw people overboard. Now, both of these systems of government are very much complicated by the factor of race. The most effective and efficient communist societies have always been those composed of Asians, because Orientals have a natural anthill mentality. And the worst societies, both capitalist and communist, have always been the ones comprised of blacks, from Africa to Detroit. Basically, niggers fuck up everything. Right, second music break. That I'm a Good Old Rebel song put me in a kind of a down-home, back-porch music mood, so here's Bill Wellington with Shaking Down the Acorns. Last week, I mentioned that I put together a series of emails that I call the Weird Aryan History series, detailing various wild and woolly episodes from our race's past. And that led to a few emails back and forth with various people, and one of them reminded me just how little our own people know of our own movement's history. I was chatting with a kid from Milwaukee named Leo, and I made reference to Ezra Pound. And he emailed me back asking, "Who's Ezra Pound?" This is from a young man who claims to be a National Socialist. Jesus. You know, I think I'm going to have to start including some kind of basic instruction section in these podcasts. There's just no excuse for anyone on our side of the fence not knowing who Ezra Pound is. During the 1920s and 1930s, Ezra Pound was America's foremost poet and arguably the greatest living poet in the English language at that time. He was to poetry what F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and William Faulkner were to literature, what Glenn Miller was to jazz, and what Clark Gable was to cinema. Yet from 1945 through 1958, Pound was held in a Washington, D.C. mental institution called St. Elizabeth's, accused of treason. Now, Pound had merely done what he'd always done, spoken his mind. Unfortunately for Pound, however, he'd made the error of criticizing the American government, and for that he was made to pay the price. Ezra Pound made a series of so-called treasonous English-language radio broadcasts from Italy, directed to both Americans and to the British during World War II. A lot of people have heard of Pound's broadcasts, but almost no one has ever actually read any of them or has any idea what he actually said. Pound himself did not consider his remarks to be treasonous. After all, he wasn't saying anything he hadn't said perfectly freely before the war, and he made the broadcasts in a desperate attempt to introduce some note of reason and logic into the insane wartime situation to try and explain to American and British servicemen just why they were fighting and dying. Pound himself said, and I quote, "If anyone takes the trouble to record and examine the series of talks I've made over this radio, it will be found that I've used three sorts of material: historical facts, convictions of experienced men based on fact, and the fruits of my own experience. The facts mostly antedate the fascist era and cannot be considered as improvisations trumped up to meet present requirements. Neither can the beliefs of Washington, John Adams, Jefferson, Jackson, Van Buren, and Lincoln be laughed off as mere fascist propaganda. And even my own observations date largely before the opening of present hostilities." And that was what really pissed off the Roosevelt regime, I think. Pound was quoting the very founding fathers to demonstrate that the war was not only unconstitutional, but insane. He also had a turn of phrase that might be expected from a poet. On the very day of Pearl Harbor, he denounced the idea that American boys should soon be marching off to war. "I do not want my compatriots from the ages of 20 to 40 to go get slaughtered to keep up the Sassoon and other British Jew rackets in Singapore and in Shanghai. That is not my idea of American patriotism." Pound believed that the American government's alliance with British finance capitalism and Soviet Bolshevism was contrary to America's tradition and heritage. Again, I quote, "Why did you take up with those gangs?" he rhetorically asked his listeners. "Two gangs, the Jews' gang in London and the one over in Moscow. Do the people from Delaware and Virginia and Connecticut and Massachusetts who live in painted neat white houses, do these folks really approve of the Soviet Jew murderers and all they stand for?" According to Pound, it was the money issue above all that united the Allies during the second 20th century war against Germany. Quote, "Gold, nothing else, uniting the three governments, England, Russia, United States of America. That is the interest, gold, usury, debt, monopoly, class interest, and possibly gross indifference and contempt for humanity. Gold is a coward. Gold is not the backbone of nations. It is their ruin. A coward, at the first breath of danger, gold flows away. Gold flows out of the country," end quote. The real enemy, said Pound, was international capitalism. All people everywhere were victims. Quote, "They're working day and night, picking your pockets," he said. "Every day and all day and all night, picking your pockets and picking the Russian working man's pockets and picking the pockets of everyone else. Capital is not international. It's not hypernational. It is subnational. A quicksand under the nations, destroying all nations, destroying all law and government, destroying the nations one at a time. Russian Empire and Austria 20 years past, France yesterday, England today." You get the idea. Pound also had a number of rather unkind things to say about Roosevelt and Churchill, which I'm sure those two syphilitic scumbags didn't appreciate. When Pound was captured after the war, his fame as a poet was so great that Roosevelt didn't dare to execute him or even bring him to trial. Instead, he was kept outdoors in an open steel cage like an animal, and later on he was confined for years in the St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital, where he was denied all reading material except for religious tracts, which, for one of the great poets and thinkers of the age, was a torture worse than any rack or electric cattle prods they might have used. They kept him in the loony bin for 13 years and finally released him in 1958. He promptly went back to Italy and lived there until his death in 1972. He never repented or recanted his views or apologized for his support of Mussolini. You know, we have a lot of heroes like that that many of our younger movement generation have never heard of, and maybe some of you older hands would like to help me out. Once more, I'd like to invite you to submit MP3 files to me, telling some of the stories that you remember from the old days and describing your own racial and political awakenings. Come on, guys, surely there's some among you besides Gretchen who have something to say to us all. A little more back porch music for you folks now, I think. I played the Kingston Trio's version of Little Maggie a few months ago, but for any well-known country or folk song, there's always about 11 different versions. This is the immortal Ralph Stanley. Now I'm going to discuss something a little on the weird side. This week, I got a communication which I don't quite know what to make of. Every instinct in my mind tells me that this is some kind of hoax by a goat dancer or some other kind of idiot, or possibly even some kind of entrapment plan on the part of the government. I have no intention of responding to this in private because I have no idea of who or what the hell I'm dealing with, and I'm not going to play silly games. But on the wild off chance that this is legitimate, I do feel that it merits some kind of reply, but out in public where there can be no doubt as to what I am saying to this person. Now it reads in part, "Mr. Covington, your low opinion of federal law enforcement officers is largely justified, but not completely. The fact is that for all the minority hiring quotas and special advancement tracks and other manifestations of diversity, most federal law enforcement personnel are still white, and not all of us are completely devoid of any moral sense as you seem to believe. As you've said in the past, we see the American government from the inside, at its most corrupt and vicious and incompetent, and we are not all immune from being affected and deeply disturbed by what goes on. Sir, you have more friends here in the corridors of power than you may realize." Oh, I do, do I? Then tell me, friend, is this moral sense of yours going to do me any good when some bureaucrat or some U.S. attorney or some federal judge decides he's had enough of my voice criticizing that nigger in the White House and his Jew buddies every week, and he gives the order to you and your people to fabricate some idiotic charge about how I supposedly tried to hire a hitman to kill somebody and then send me off to die in prison because I make you people in power uncomfortable? And if your so-called friendship and sympathy don't extend that far, then what the hell good is it? You people put on your cowardly body armor, and you wave your M16s in the air and yell and scream, and you kick in doors in the dawn for no other crime than a white man's refusal to bow down and think the way your bosses tell him to and live his life the way your bosses tell him to. You terrorize children, you destroy families, forever you commit torture and murder, and you think a little genteel brooding about the angst of it all over the after-dinner cognac at night gets you off the moral hook? That's not how it works, you sons of bitches. You federal badges all have some very serious debts to pay. One day, you're going to pay them, and I hope one way or the other I'm around to see it happen. Whatever else happens to me, it will make everything in my life worth it to see you wretched hirelings who served evil for money and power and medical insurance get what I suspect you know in your hearts you deserve. The most drunken skinhead, the nuttiest right-wing tinfoil hate conspiracy theorist, and the most ignorant Georgia cracker Klansman are all better men than you. You're dogs. None of you are worth a bucket of warm piss. But okay, let's say I'm wrong about that. Let's say that there are a few of you out there who still have some remnant of a conscience and a few remaining shreds of human decency. White men and women, of course. Non-white federal agents aren't genetically capable of understanding that what they're doing is evil or even understanding that there is such a thing. And Jews actively embrace it since they're creations of evil themselves. But let's say that there are a few white federal badges out there, FBI, BATFE, Homeland Security, whoever, being carried by people whose souls have not yet completely rotted away, and that the person who sent me this communication is one such. I doubt it. I've never seen any sign that any of you have any decency at all or ever did. After all, you're the people who shot down Vicky Weaver in her doorway as she stood holding her baby. You're the people who burned children alive in Waco. You're the people who regularly send men in their 70s and 80s to die in prison because back 50 years ago they dared to resist integration. You're the people who made up silly stories about poor doped-up derelicts planning to kill your head nigger while wearing white sequined tuxedos. You're the people who arrested a young man and sent him into living hell for posting a poem on the internet. You're the people who dragged a man of 64 just recovering from open-heart surgery into prison on charges so ridiculous that no one believes them, and then stole everything he had so he couldn't hire a decent lawyer to refute your lies. People like you don't have any decency or humanity left, but okay, let's assume, for the sake of argument, that I'm wrong, and that some of you at least have enough grace to be ashamed of what you're doing, if nothing else. So what do I say to you? I won't ask you to help us, because no matter how bad you may feel about what you're doing and the way that you live your life, we both know that's not going to happen. You're not going to turn away from the monthly direct deposit pay slip, the nice big black luxury cars and SUVs you get to drive, the silk suits, the split-level ranch houses in the suburbs out there in Silver Spring or Falls Church, the medical insurance and the great 401k. Of course, since your nigger Barry has so badly fucked up the economy, you may not have those things much longer, but we won't get into that now. Above all, you won't turn your back on the power, will you, Mr. or Miss G-Man? That's why you joined the Bureau, or the Department, or whatever to begin with. You wanted power. The power to spy on people, like you're spying on me right now. The power to interfere in people's lives. The power to manipulate other human beings like you're a little girl playing dollies in some kind of Mad Hatter's tea party. The power and the permission from some political gangster in a black robe to hurt people. The gun on your hip and the badge in your pocket that gives you the authority to kill and arrest and handcuff and beat and waterboard and throw prisoners in with niggers to be sodomized. That's what you really wanted in exchange for your soul and your humanity, and that's what you got. But now it bothers you, huh? Something inside you just won't go away, and it keeps whispering to you that something's wrong, huh? You look around, and you see who your bosses are and what they're doing. You see who's running the show and how they're running it. You've got enough sense to figure out what's going to happen a few years down the pike if all this goes on. You know what's coming, and it scares you shitless. You've been listening to me for some months now, and you know that I'm right, so much so that you couldn't resist sending me that email. Hell, maybe you were drunk when you sent it. How many martinis did it take you to work up the courage? And why did you send it? What exactly is it that you want from me? Forgiveness? No. What you do is unforgivable. Don't bother to ask forgiveness from Vicky Weaver or the children of Waco or the Muslims you tortured or Johnny Logan Spencer either. I can tell you right now, they don't forgive you. But if you really do have some faint spark of the human spirit left in you, some final gasp of conscience, so that you feel bad enough about what you do to at least contact me, then okay, I'll give you some advice. Take it or leave it. Save your soul, my alleged friend. When you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you have to do before you can climb out is to stop digging. Resign. Quit. Type out your notice to the Bureau or the BATFE or the U.S. Marshals or whoever. Hand it in tomorrow. Walk out the door and never look back. There must be 50 ways to leave Obama. Just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Sam. No need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Don't worry about another job or anything like that. 30 million Americans are looking for work, and it will be good for your soul to rejoin the human race and be one of them. Bad, bad times are coming, and if you haven't already been asked to do something really horrible, something that will utterly destroy what's left of your humanity and earn you eternal damnation, then you will be soon. Because when the regime feels really threatened, they're going to react like cornered rats and attack with tooth and claw. Don't fool yourselves that if you stay, you can somehow do some good by working within the system. No, you can't. That's just an excuse so you won't have to give up the money and the perks and the shiny black cars. The system is beyond redemption, and you know it as well as I do. Hell, you know it better than I do. Like you said, you see it from the inside. I'm not a Christian, and I won't bother to look up chapter and verse, but somewhere in the Bible, there's a line that reads, "But what profit a man to gain the whole world if he lose his own soul?" What indeed? Whoever the hell you are, if you meant what you said, then I'm truly sorry for you, but there's no escape. There's only one right thing left for you to do. Resign, get the hell out, go thou and sin no more. And if it means you end up being a night watchman at Walmart, then so be it. When it finally hits the fan, you can use the skill sets you acquired with the Bureau if you choose, and this time you can do it with a white hat on your head. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Andenbahn, freedom.